You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner to English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 209 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 lectures. Translated by Agnes, I'm going to try it this time, Schneeborg de Stur. I hope I'm pronouncing that right one way or the other. Entitled The Language of the Cosmos. This is the second section, one lecture, in a section called Father Consciousness and Christ Consciousness. I am numbering it number 4 in the book, just to keep them all in a numerical order. And it's given in Berlin on December 7th, 1921. What I would like to bring to you today will have a certain connection with what I was privileged to present here last time, and will therefore relate to some of the things mentioned at that time. I would like to speak today of certain materialistic tendencies in contemporary religious confessions, but I would like to do this in connection with a particular aspect of the Christ question. It is especially in relation to the Christ question that a whole series of misunderstandings about anthroposophic research emerges. And much will depend on dispelling these misunderstandings, even if this may not do much for those who circulate them out of a particular interest, but for others it might make a difference. In the more recent phases of the development of Western culture, we have experienced a propensity in various ways for pronounced atheistic world conceptions. It cannot be my task today to point out the different nuances of atheism that have emerged, but I would like to draw your attention to something that is basic to any of these atheistic worldviews. It is the failure to look at the actual source from which the idea of a God consciousness originates. A God consciousness cannot arise solely from the contemplation of external nature, but rather from human coexistence with external nature, with the sense-perceptible world. It may seem paradoxical for me to say that a God consciousness in human beings has to arise from living in the world of the senses. But this awareness of God should not be seen as the fruition of a moment, so to speak, but rather as the essence of earthly life from birth to death. In this life on earth, we experience ourselves, to begin with, as related to nature through the process of heredity. We entered this earthly existence as physical human beings by way of purely natural processes. As we pass through this earthly existence, we recognize that what we were supplied with at birth undergoes a certain development. And then it becomes a question of whether we are sufficiently diligent. Naturally, I do not mean this only in an intellectual sense, but also with respect to our feelings and our impulses of will, both of which are also meant to come into play and be experienced, whether we achieve a certain conscious awareness of this living together with the outer sensory world in the course of our life on earth. If we combine, purely out of generally accepted experiences, everything that the world of the senses can give us, then this will never lead us to understand our entire human nature, unless we think of the world of the senses, and what it can become when we participate in it, as being permeated with spirit. No matter how carefully we examine all the mysteries which the outer world of the senses can give us through our physical perception, we can never come to understand the fact that the human being is also placed in this world of the senses. However, since we as physical, earthly beings nevertheless have our roots in this world of the senses, but will never be able to deduce what we are as human beings from our physical components, it follows that in order to have a sound consciousness, this consciousness achieves its fulfillment with the being of God, or rather with the conception of the divine being. And what natural science, notwithstanding its great comprehensive successes, has particularly brought to humanity is the fact that because it does not want to recognize the spiritual as such within the sensory world, It places the human being outside its comprehensive field of research, as it were. I have described this on earlier occasions when I said, quote, if we look, for example, at the modern theory of evolution, which is astounding in many respects, then we find that it deals with the human being not as the human being, but rather as the conclusion, the culmination, the crown of the animal kingdom, close quote. If we ask what natural science, as it is constituted today, has to say about the nature of the human being, then understood correctly, we do not actually receive an answer. Science is really only answering the question, quote, which is the highest developed of the animals, close quote. In other words, it considers the human being only from the perspective of being an animal. In many respects, science is right in what it has to say about this topic, but in doing so, it places the human being outside its field of observation, as it were. With the means available to it, natural science is actually unable to answer the question concerning the nature of the human being. As a matter of fact, science can really only understand itself rightfully by stating that this question about the nature of the human being falls outside its domain. It can obviously only be an indication of a specific feeling that arises from the entire makeup of a healthy human being, especially insofar as we understand ourselves to be related to the whole of nature, when it is said that the human being must, in fact, come to a God consciousness, although initially only to a consciousness of God, not to a consciousness of Christ. Now, it is actually not possible for someone using sound intelligence and healthy feelings to be an atheist. I already referred to this on an earlier occasion when I said, quote, even if it is obvious that not every mild illness can be diagnosed with the usual available means, it is nevertheless clear to anyone who can distinguish between health and illness in human beings that atheism can, to begin with, only become entrenched when the whole human nature has an unhealthy predisposition, close quote. It can therefore be said that denying God is actually the outcome of ill health. But what is really occurring in this respect is the following. In the present stage of human evolution, we come to this God consciousness only in what I would call a wavering, doubtful way, if one looks at it from a wider context. For here it becomes important to draw attention to a significant deficiency in our current pedagogical methods, a deficiency which, for example, the Waldorf pedagogy is trying to correct. Whenever the decline of our present civilization is discussed, one cannot really overlook today's youth movement. This youth movement is more important than one usually thinks. And I actually consider it extraordinarily significant that at a number of recent events of our anthroposophic movement, including the last Stuttgart Congress, a considerable number of people belonging to the youth movement were present, and at that time actually made the very positive decision, also seen from the perspective of the youth movement itself, to join forces with the aims of our anthroposophic spiritual endeavors. Think what you may about certain aspects of this youth movement, but it needs to be acknowledged that for large numbers of our youth, the authority of the older generation, which should provide leadership to young people, has faded. Even if there is much to criticize about today's youth, one cannot dismiss the fact that when these young people begin to say that they can no longer accept authority in what comes to meet them, then it is not only the youth who are to be blamed for this, but rather the older people who ought to give them this guidance. Recently, during a lecture I gave in Aarau, Switzerland, this very question regarding the lack of authority among today's young people was discussed. And then it happened that after the lecture, a representative of a religious confession stepped forward and ranted about the youth of today. But this kind of grumbling does not achieve anything with respect to what is actually emerging here with such elementary force. One needs to understand these things. It was interesting that after this happened, a young lad from one of the local schools, comparable to a secondary school, stood up and gave, in my opinion, the best counter-speech. He stepped up with great enthusiasm and said, quote, We want authority. We actually long for authority. But when we look at the old people, do we see anything besides the fact that no authority can come from these old people at all? We see them feuding at every opportunity, always at loggerheads. Close quote. And then he listed all sorts of things that young people today notice about old people. And finally he said, quote, "We thirst for authority, but we are not able to find it." Close quote. If we evaluate what is really taking place, however, then we will find that today's civilization has become intellectualistic to a high degree, that basically everything that sets the tone today and considers itself to be the definitive authority has become intellectualistic, rationalistic. Strictly speaking, science and rationalism belong together. Natural science comprises what is objective, rationalism what is subjective. But this rational culture, this intellectualism, emerges in a natural way only at a certain age. As a child, one cannot be rationalistic at all. Children are not intellectuals. Intellectualism can actually only arise after sexual maturity. And since humanity has completely descended into intellectualism, everything is dominated by it today. And those who repeatedly reject and scold intellectualism today often do so all the more based on a different kind of intellectualism. People laying claim to intellectualism today are abstract thinkers. But one can, in reality, only descend into intellectualism at a later age, and because we become so submerged in it, the children no longer understand us and have no use for the thought forms we adopt while under the influence of intellectualism. Moreover, we ourselves no longer have a sense of what we absorbed when we were children. Childhood is no longer fully alive in us. We have become so terribly clever intellectually that the child in us no longer plays any role for us. But we cannot be educators if we have been thoroughly abandoned by what we experienced as children. Consequently, we no longer know what to say to the children, and they grow up without any special care of their essential being. We proclaim that we must be transparent, but transparency is only the objective side of intellectualism. By doing this, we create a chasm between us and the young people, and this is what confronts us in the youth movement. But again, nothing is accomplished by simply scolding intellectualism, for it has entered Western civilization as a necessary phenomenon in the last 3 to 5 centuries. Actually since the period spanning the 13th to the 15th century. This intellectualism had to develop so that humanity could really enter into the impulse of freedom. Accordingly, it is not a matter of merely criticizing this intellectualistic impulse. Rather, it is a matter of understanding this impulse in the right way, so as to be able, through such understanding, to strive for continuing development in a direction different from the intellectualistic one. And now we must ask, quote, what is the real meaning of this intellectualism? Close quote. An indication of this was actually already given through the fact that one can point to the connection between intellectualism and the sense of freedom. And this feeling of freedom, in turn, cannot be thought of without the whole development of the human eye, capital. The development of the eye has evolved in a specific way in modern times, and now works on the eye, capital, through the consciousness soul. That is, in essence, what appears as the impulse of modern Western civilization. But this eye, which human beings have become fully conscious of over the past 3, 4, 5 centuries, can initially only develop from the human body. The experience of the eye between birth and death can only arise from the human physical body. This can be verified, especially through anthroposophic spiritual research. One of the most important moments of the whole life after death is the moment of dying itself. This moment of dying is, of course, only known to the earthly human being from its external aspects. The inner aspects of it must be recognized out of the consciousness which the dead themselves have between death and a new birth. Exactly how soon after death this emerges is not our concern at this point. Today, we want to consider from a more general point of view the consciousness of a human being between death and a new birth. This consciousness is entirely dependent on the fact that the human being receives an extraordinarily significant impression at the moment of death. Just consider that during the whole life between birth and death, we only leave our physical and etheric bodies, with our eye and our astral body, in the state of sleep. So that during life between birth and death, there is a constant, uninterrupted connection between the physical body and the etheric body. In death, we leave the physical body with our etheric body. As you know, we remain together with our etheric body for a number of days. So that we have this experience of our full physical body only at the moment of death. If one wants to have knowledge of something, there is no other way to acquire it than for the object of this knowledge to be outside of oneself. You can only have knowledge of something that is outside of yourself. You cannot see what is in your eye, EYE, only what is outside the eye. Neither can you see anything in a soul spiritual sense of what you have within yourself. You must first go outside of yourself with your soul spiritual being. Then you can see the external aspect of your body. This is what happens at the moment of dying with respect to the separation of the etheric and the physical body. In falling asleep, we never really have a conscious, complete view of our physical body and our etheric body. These two remain behind when falling asleep. It is for this reason that when one attains a seeing consciousness during sleep, one can only see the human head and part of the torso, and not really the human limbs during ordinary sleep. It is only in death, in dying, that the moment arrives when the human being encounters himself in terms of his physical body as a whole, complete object. And for the entire time between death and a new birth, this impression remains as the last thing, one might say, of the aspect which a human being looks back upon after death. The human being observes this moment of dying, for we would not be able to recognize the I, capital, in relation to ourselves. In other words, we would be I-less. If we were not able to see this I as an object by virtue of the fact that what we are conscious of here in the physical world, namely the physical body as such, is now in front of us as an object of knowledge at the moment of dying. This tremendous impression, the fact that we can say to ourselves, quote, what you experienced at the moment of death is what your I consciousness made possible for you, namely to see your whole, complete physical body. Close quote. This impression remains and forms the content of the I consciousness between death and a new birth, where everything becomes temporal, where, in a certain sense, the spatial is no longer there. The human being looks back from that particular point after death and sees this significant moment as the last thing of this whole perspective. Its course continues, but the rays cross at the moment of death, namely the moment of dying. This is what then works after death as, quote, time organism, close quote, one might say, in the same way as our spatial physical organism provides the I consciousness between birth and death. Accordingly, we can say, quote, the I consciousness here in earthly life actually comes from the physical body, close quote. What is involved here is the following. You look out into outer nature through your senses. You see the three kingdoms of nature, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, and also the physical human kingdom. You see clouds, rivers, mountains, stars, and so on. Everything you see in this way can be considered nature. And what you see also supplies the elements that are absorbed by the human organism, both the physical and the etheric. With your food, you absorb the substances of the physical sensory world. These substances unfold their physical and chemical forces and functions, even when they are in the human organism. One could say that in terms of our physical organism, we are what we ingest from external nature. Minerals, plants, animals are permitted, if I may put it that way, to be nature. They have the right to be nature. But when that which is contained in them is absorbed into the human organism, as food or through respiration, for example, then it becomes something other than nature. Then it becomes something in the human organism that can be described by saying, if the human being is to remain human, then what exists as nature is actually not allowed to remain nature. Nature entities only have the right to be nature outside of the human being. Within the human being, nature becomes a destructive element. There, it becomes something which continually aims to dissolve and which also generates forces in the realm of the soul that work toward destruction. What the ancient instinctive human consciousness perceived in this sense was far more correct than what modern-day intellectualism perceives. Today's intellectualism takes its start from concepts, not from facts. And when the facts do not agree with the concepts, it reinterprets the phenomena in accordance with its concepts. Nowadays, people do not say that plants, animals, and human beings have an end, but rather that one should investigate death. People do not really consider the fact that the end of plants, of animals, and of human beings might well be something completely different, something that cannot be summed up under the common concept of death. And if one draws attention to such things, then the world considers this grotesque or paradoxical. This is how things are evaluated today. But that would actually be like saying, quote, a knife is a knife, close quote, and then proceeding to carve a piece of meat with a razor blade because, quote, a knife is a knife, close quote. Nowadays, when people believe that they have both feet firmly planted in reality, it becomes a question of recognizing that reality cannot be attained with abstract concepts. This is something that intellectualism, which has concepts as its starting point instead of facts, does not take into account. Hence, it also does not realize that the ancient people, speaking out of older forms of consciousness, were justified in saying that nature, in its activities and its processes, no longer has the right to remain nature once it enters the human being and continues its existence there. That instead it must be transformed, and that if it wants to retain its validity as nature, it becomes, in quotes, sin in the human being. People no longer look at the concept of sin in connection with natural phenomena. They do not consider the bridge between the natural world and what is rooted in the human being as the soul's spiritual element. The animals, plants, minerals have the right to be nature outside, but what enters the human being from these kingdoms must be transformed by the human being, for if it were to remain nature, it would be transmuted into something destructive. In other words, if it enters purely as nature and the human being does not have the strength to transform it, then it becomes illness. And inasmuch as it expresses itself in the soul, it becomes sin. Now, if we are unprejudiced in contemplating our relation to the sense-perceptible world, if we truly observe ourselves, if we account for everything that can be taken into account in this realm, then we must come to the following realization. When I look out at nature and initially consider how I have developed out of it, then I cannot be an atheist. On the other hand, however, it is precisely as a human being today, as a human being of more recent times, that I must ascribe my I consciousness only to my physical body, to nature as it exists within me. What has been described here in thought form is indeed present, as a perception or a feeling, in every healthy person who is not afraid of developing self-knowledge today. If we really observe our own inner self, instead of avoiding this out of fear or convenience, then we will experience a predicament that can be expressed in this way. Quote, if I regard myself as a being of nature, as proceeding from nature, then a divine being must be at the foundation of the whole world, to which I also belong. Close quote. But in reality, this healthy sense is at variance with the present-day development of the I capital, because this development can only arise from the nature-based existence of the physical body, and, as I have already described, through the impression that dying makes on the human being. And so the inevitable consequence of this is that the modern human being must, quite instinctively, develop doubts regarding an awareness of God, not because something in the observation of nature would lead away from a God consciousness, but because the human being of today, as a unitary being comprised of body, soul, and spirit, can actually not be entirely healthy as a result of the I consciousness. For nature, if it remains as it is within the human being and then affects the soul, implies something that will cause illness, and on the soul level something that has the effect of straying, of sinning. One should, of course, not view these things in a dogmatic way, but it is important to be mindful of the facts and of how they are revealed in life. In this context, this means that if we go back to ancient times, when the I consciousness was not yet present, the divine being, regardless of how it was pictured, was always imagined based on a father concept. People could not imagine the divine being in any other way than as a unified God being, who embraced all or part of the world, and whom they sought to grasp based on the father concept. And since the I consciousness was not yet present, since it can only arise from the nature-based aspect, there was nothing that could interfere with this father consciousness. As modern human beings, we can actually only have this father consciousness if, conceivably, through moral strengthening, we nonetheless subdue our I capital and thus bypass something that must occur through the development of freedom along with the development of modern humanity. This is why, as human beings living today, we can actually not be content with the one consciousness, the father consciousness. We must say, quote, I would in fact have this father consciousness today if I were still able to live instinctively, as humanity did before the feeling of I became stronger. But as a human being of the present time, my I consciousness impedes a full encounter with this father consciousness because I am no longer in a state of dependence. Close quote. As modern human beings, we can indeed experience what occurs in this respect, inasmuch as we think about the I and are aware that the I is extinguished when it is not tied to the body. In falling asleep, it is extinguished. In death, it is able to sustain itself only because it views the body in dying. As human beings, we know that it is actually our I consciousness that leads us away from having an awareness of the Divine Father. We must, however, experience this as something unhealthy. And if we experience it in the right way as unhealthy, then an impulse will arise in us that guides us to Christ, as he is present today. A Son, S-O-N, consciousness will have to arise from our inner soul experience to add to a Father consciousness. This Son consciousness can only enter us through an act of freedom. And we must indeed come to the following realization. Just as atheism is in reality a manifestation of illness, so is what may be called agnosticism regarding the mystery of Golgotha, and specifically agnosticism regarding the ever-present Christ, a misfortune, a blow of fate. We can actually not be completely healthy when the Father consciousness has forsaken us, and in this respect, modern humanity is in fact not completely healthy. But if we want to come to Christ, then it requires an activity, a free deed, of finding the Christ Spirit being. Two experiences are absolutely necessary. To begin with, the consciousness with respect to the Father, But it must be realized that in the present phase of human evolution, this awareness of the Father is dimmed, clouded. If we had not acquired our eye consciousness in the course of human evolution, the awareness of a divine Father would be there. But because the eye consciousness actually wells up, must well up, from that which, left to itself, is sick in the human being, the awareness of a divine Father is clouded for people in the present time. And we must come to an awareness of Christ through a free deed, which is different from finding the Father. As I had already indicated here on an earlier occasion, these two experiences are not distinguished from one another in Western civilization. One will find, however, that it is particularly Soloviev who, out of a different kind of consciousness, strictly distinguishes the Father consciousness from the Son consciousness. In the West, the distinction between the two is so minuscule that a typical portrayal, seen by many as authoritative, regarding the nature of Christianity could even state, quote, "The Son does not actually belong in the Gospels, only the Father. The Son only in so far as he is a teacher about the Father," close quote. Consequently, there is no awareness that people can have two spheres of experience, one with respect to the Father, an experience that is clouded today, and another one with respect to the Son. Now, if one has this experience of the Son, one would initially only experience an encounter with Christ as he exists today. And anyone can have such a present-day encounter with Christ, with the eternal Christ, as it were, resulting from the subjective relationship as it exists today. However, if one rejects this present-day encounter with Christ and instead lives with a dampened awareness, as humanity did in earlier times, then one will not attain the inner disposition that leads to an encounter with Christ. But if a person really senses what is possible in our time, then he or she will come to this inner deed of meeting Christ, and through that very deed prove that Christ is here. However, it is still necessary to study the historical Christ. But then it becomes important to be able to look at history from a different perspective than the one available to the outwardly focused consciousness of today, in this age of materialism. Here I must draw your attention to something that should be strictly observed. The fact that light can be shed on the higher worlds is usually taken too much in an outer sense. People are still not listening carefully enough to realize that a person speaking of the higher worlds must in fact speak in a different style than someone speaking of the physical world. That is to say, not just in a different outer style, but in a different inner style. When we live here in the physical world and let this world have an impact on us, we distinguish with our present-day consciousness, using what one might call logical reasoning, between right and wrong. We also may call it true and false. And we check, based on reasons that are logical and grounded in reality, whether something is right or wrong, true or false. But this is precisely how we get into abstractions, into an intellectual mode of life, because all logical distinctions as to whether something is true or false are driven by abstract concepts if observations and investigations are based only on external sensory perception. The process of cognition moves in abstract concepts. But this kind of abstractness with respect to concepts cannot be maintained when we ascend into the higher worlds. There everything becomes much more alive, and also appears as something that is alive, rather than as something that has merely been thought. For this reason, a person observing the higher worlds should not only speak of true or false, right or wrong, one must of course do that too, but should speak, for example, of something that is correctly reflected in the physical world as healthy, and of something that is incorrectly reflected as sick. Even with respect to the lowest level of the higher worlds, it is by no means correct to speak of true and false. For in this world, everything is concerned with things that are healthy or unhealthy, wholesome or unwholesome. Therefore, if people with a view to abstract logic are speaking about the higher worlds in the same way as they would speak of the physical world, then it is obvious that they do not have a real perception of the higher worlds. Now, something very remarkable arises as regards the historical development of humanity. If we take an unbiased look at this history, we find that it shows ancient epochs filled with wisdom. And if one has a sound sense, one will develop a feeling of deep reverence for the primordial wisdom of these older epochs. If we look, for example, at what is reflected in the Vedas, in the Vedanta philosophy, from the perspective of its origin, then we will recognize that it has indeed been drawn from and revealed out of such deep wisdom-based foundations that we must have the deepest reverence for it. Then we approach this primordial wisdom of humanity in a different way than the abstract scholarship of today is able to approach it. But this primordial wisdom gradually dwindled, one could say, as humanity advanced in its development. And we find that the dulling of this primordial wisdom-filled consciousness of humanity culminated in the period during which the mystery of Golgotha took place. It is not really necessary to take account of anything that is contained in the older external records, insofar as these records, for example the Gospels, describe the mystery of Golgotha verbatim. We only need to take an impartial look, but now from a higher perspective, at the historical development of humanity, and we will find that the further back we go, the more we see this primordial wisdom becoming increasingly obscured in the human soul. What eventually came to full expression in the 15th century had already been indicated in the Greek and Latin Roman era. Essentially, all that humanity still had of this primeval wisdom was traditions. This wisdom was no longer experienced. And what we see increasingly emerging instead is full eye consciousness. In this respect, our external science has not discovered much of what especially needs to be studied about this era, which is also the time in which the mystery of Golgotha occurred. Tremendous predicaments arise today when we consider, for example, the Greek alphabet, where the letters still have names, alpha, beta, gamma, and tracing its development through later times, the Latin alphabet, where letters no longer have names. Such transitions, which point in a profound way to historical phases of development, are not generally considered at all. For example, no attention is paid to what our word, alphabet, which is still taken from the Greek, actually means. If one looks into this, and a true science of linguistics will be able to investigate these things, then it will emerge that essentially the same reality is expressed with the Greek alpha, as is pronounced in the Old Testament, with the words, "the human being was infused with the breath of life," and that therefore this breath must be seen as the element which in the beginning made the human being. If you examine the word alpha in the right way, and it is actually a word, then you will find that it is, quote, "the human being," close quote. The first letter of the alphabet is nothing other than the word for the human being, and beta is the house. Therefore, the beginning of the alphabet means, quote, "the human being in his house," close quote. This view of the alphabet has been lost in later times as intellectualism became more and more established. From then on, the letters were only used as a way to distinguish external things. What was contained in the revelation of the primordial wisdom became dissociated. The word of the primordial revelation became externalized, and people no longer understood what was revealed to humanity in the letters, that is to say, in the words. There is a lot of talk today in the traditional lodges and orders of the, quote, "hidden secret word," close quote, but humanity knows very little of what was contained as a reality in this secret word. How the alphabet itself actually expressed the hidden word, and how it then became atomized, fragmented. I could, of course, also begin with something else in order to show what a profoundly decisive impulse was driving evolution at the time of Greek and Latin culture. The way Greek culture, with the help of a special art form, sought to lift itself above what I would like to call this unhealthy state arising in humanity. This is palpable for anyone willing to see. I would like to draw your attention to one thing in particular. Today, when people talk about drama, for example, they think that this is something to look at, something that belongs in the domain of life's luxuries. People watch it and then call it beautiful. But for the Greeks, the most important element in the drama was the idea of catharsis, of cleansing, of purification. This was something that signified not only an external fantasy-filled event, but one that clearly points to its medicinal origin. Catharsis is the crisis that is overcome. And in the Greek tragedy, the soul was brought into a crisis in such a way that by experiencing fear and pity, it underwent a purification as it was exposed to the effects of these contrasting forces in the course of the drama. The Greeks did not think of this art form in a benosic sense at all, but rather as of something with definite healing qualities, for they still perceived an ancient wisdom governing it. For them, it still was filled with a healthy primordial wisdom, which, however, dwindled over the course of time, and then a disease process of sorts arose. With this art form, the Greeks wanted to express more or less the following. There is something in humanity that is in need of healing. Nietzsche, incidentally, had an inkling of this. One can read about it in his book titled The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. The therapeutae, the Essenes, always assumed that there was something in humanity that was in need of healing. And if the mystery of Golgotha had not come to pass for humanity, if our lives were such today that I would have to speak without a mystery of Golgotha having occurred, then I would only be able to describe a humanity affected by a disease process. This means that something about the mystery of Golgotha is clarified for us when we apply the terms healthy and sick to the history of humanity. The important point here is that even if you were to apply all concepts relating to right and wrong, you will come to a point in the course of development where you will have to look at things differently. For once you come to the Greek epoch, you are coming to a time when a disease process entered humanity and health could only come from the mystery of Golgotha. The therapeutae pointed this out and said, quote, "This is where the great therapeute emerges, the Savior, who, in the literal sense of the word, has to heal humanity." Close quote. It is simply a matter of delving deeply enough into the course of human evolution, of not staying with the usual abstract concepts, but rather approaching historical life with the aid of medical concepts, according to categories of healthy and sick. Then we will understand the need for a healing process, and will also understand how the Savior, the healer, this word means nothing other than the therapeute, intercedes for humanity. Then we will understand that something had to intervene in the evolution of humanity, which could not be accomplished through the forces that were present in humanity at an earlier time. A new impulse had to come from extra-earthly realms for the healing of humanity. This is how one can look at the historical development, and this is, in fact, how one must look at it, if, without heeding the content of historical records, one focuses strictly on the configuration of the development of humanity. Then one comes to the concept of an extra-earthly Christ, who connected himself out of extra-earthly regions with the evolution of the earth through the mystery of Golgotha. This way of looking at things must come into effect if one wants to understand history. If people do not want to adopt this way of observing according to the concepts of healthy and sick, and apply it to the evolution of history, then they will have to acknowledge that history remains incomprehensible to them. They will not be able to understand what once lived in the East, and how it passed over to Africa, and then developed into the Greek-Roman culture. We view the Greek development, correctly, as an exceptionally healthy one. Why? Because the Greeks had a sense that it was necessary to battle diseases, and that they wanted to organize their lives accordingly. And with respect to this feeling, the sense that there was something that needed to be fought. There was a particularly remarkable harmony among the individual Greek personalities. On the other hand, the situation of no longer having this sense and of moving more and more toward abstractionism, which turned even the gods into an abstraction, became the peculiar characteristic of the Roman civilization and remained so. Europe was influenced by Romanism until the 15th century, after which the cosmic Christ began to enter human consciousness. Before that, it was Romanism that carried Christ to the West. I wanted to offer these few remarks here today so that we can gradually come to understand what actually stands before us in the mystery of Golgotha, and that we should not just focus on what developed from ancient times up to the time of the mystery of Golgotha. If one proceeds in this way, it will become clear that there really is no longer any difference between what certain theologians put forward in their teachings about Jesus and what a secular historian, such as Ranke, maintains. That one can no longer distinguish between what certain theologians say about the Jesus story and what a man like Ranke, for example, says about it. All this should really be based, however, on the realization that Christ, as an extra-earthly being united with Jesus of Nazareth, who was born as a human being in the course of time. It is precisely at this point that something arises which has led to the greatest misunderstandings with regard to how anthroposophy must, of necessity, approach the mystery of Golgotha. It was an inherent part of all ancient instinctive wisdom that it did not separate the spiritual from the physical. For if these two are separated, then in the case of the physical, one comes to an impossible concept of matter. And in the case of the spiritual, that is, how human beings experience the spiritual, one actually comes to abstractionism, to a lifeless system of concepts. It became emblematic only of modern humanity to separate the material and the spiritual from one another in this way. And so, anthroposophy guides us to understand again how we should regard nature as a whole, or one could say how we should look at it as a physiognomy. For we look at a physiognomy in such a way that we think of it as ensouled. We read from it that it is permeated with soul. This is how it used to be in the primordial wisdom, and this is how the light-imbued newer wisdom today also leads us again to a physiognomic beholding of the starry world, for example. This then leads to something that allows us to approach Christ as the sun being, which does not mean, however, that Christ is the physical sun being, just as a human being is not a physical bodily being. And it is only in this way that we can understand how something extra-earthly could have dwelt in Jesus of Nazareth, who lived in Palestine. But this idea is cloaked in extreme misunderstandings, especially among theologians. People even find it insulting that anthroposophy connects Christ with the sun and with the external cosmic world in general. Why is this so? It is actually quite characteristic. Anthroposophy calls attention again to Christ's connection with the sun, S-U-N. But to these people, the sun is, after all, merely a burning nebula ball out there. Hence, it is offensive to associate this burning solar nebula ball with Christ. We know, however, that theology has become materialistic and can therefore only regard the cosmos as a material world. Anthroposophy, on the other hand, shows how this material world is permeated with spirit everywhere. But because theology is unable to detach itself from the material, it feels offended when anthroposophy speaks of Christ as a sun being. It is from this kind of materialism, from a profoundly materialistic view of the world, that this particular point of our Christology is considered offensive. Here you can see how materialism digs its way into everything. It has especially taken hold of theology, and because theology has become materialistic, it contributes to misunderstandings of this type regarding anthroposophy. Coming from the ordinary world, one can only be a materialist. And if anyone states that Christ descended from this world, then this can only be understood in a materialistic sense, and that is insulting. It is important to point out in this connection that our whole culture is becoming materialistic, but is afraid to acknowledge what really lies at its foundations. However, if we want to move away from this decline toward a new ascent, then we must look at these underlying foundations without bias, fear, or apprehension. We must get away from the very thing that has brought European and Western humanity in general into this downward slide, which has led to these terrible catastrophes. The only suitable way to achieve this is through knowledge, fearless knowledge, of everything that human beings can learn about the world. And it is also necessary, when ascending into the higher worlds, that we determine in an unbiased manner which aspects of the realm of intellectualism are really not suitable. There are many people today who still say, quote, "What is communicated about the higher worlds is rather strange. One cannot understand it unless one actually enters these worlds oneself," close quote. But this is not correct. People believe this to be the case because they accept only those concepts that apply to the physical world, concepts we have between birth and death. For example, there is a prevailing belief today, precisely because everything is developed from concepts, despite the fact that people consider themselves to be inductive and empirical, that it is absolutely possible to convey the complete ultimate picture. We must, of course, say that when the human being falls asleep, the eye and the astral body leave the physical and etheric bodies, and that the individual remains unconscious until he or she wakes up again. These words describe what is the normal, healthy situation for humanity today, but they do not apply to humanity's evolution as a whole. If we look back, for example, specifically to those times that gave rise to the Indian and the ancient Persian cultures, then we find that there was a different idea underlying everything. The idea, namely, that the human being, when falling asleep, descended more deeply with the eye and astral body into the physical and etheric bodies than was the case during the day when awake. The ancient Indians did not say, quote, "The human being withdraws with the eye and astral body from the physical and etheric bodies when falling asleep," close quote. Although the theosophists want people to believe that the Indians would have spoken like that. Instead, what they really said was, quote, "When people fall asleep, they actually descend deeper into their physical and etheric bodies," close quote. And this is essentially quite correct. For this situation is indeed comparable to someone endeavoring to say, in an absolute sense, quote, "As far as the earth is concerned, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west," close quote. But this is not actually the case, because for the other half of the earth the process is reversed. And even though one might call it east and west, the directional relationships are different. In the same way, it is absolutely a fact that during a certain time period, the eye and the astral body went down more deeply into the physical and etheric bodies, and that as a result, the experience was quite different. It is for this reason, too, that the ancient Indians expressed themselves quite differently, because they were embedded in a different kind of consciousness, one which today's human being is not fully conscious of either. Namely, what governs the rhythmic and metabolic functions? We are not conscious of these processes. To our human consciousness today, the situation is such that we are in a dream state with respect to the rhythmic functions, and in a sleep state with respect to the metabolic functions. This is why the following can be said. It should be quite understandable that certain things, which according to some people today can be spoken of in an absolute sense, were actually experienced very differently by people at different times, and that we can only understand the historical development if we let the facts speak about these things, not the concepts we might have construed for ourselves. At the present time, when West and East, Occident and Orient, are facing each other in such a fiery manner that a compromise must be found, it is important that humanity be able to explore these backgrounds. Failing this, there may be as many Washington conferences as people wish. They will end in nothing, if the basic impulses of humanity's development are not addressed. People still do not really believe that today, but it is true nonetheless that we must look into what motivates humanity in its innermost being, if we want to move from manifestations of decline toward an ascent. What is required here may well appear to be impractical today, but when it comes to the truly impractical, which has turned out to be such, became even more impractical between 1914 and 1918 and still is today, people do not realize how impractical it actually is. But in addition to all this, we must also learn to recognize how a religious consciousness can also be illuminated and deepened through the anthroposophic way of looking at things. Today I could only describe one of the paths leading to the cosmic extra-earthly Christ and how it can be found. But you will be able to see how a deeper understanding of history can then develop from this, one that regards humanity as a living being. And just as we generally speak of health and illness with regard to a living being, so must we also speak of health and illness in the case of humanity, if we want to get beyond materialism. People cannot say that it is difficult to find their way to Christ, if clearly the corresponding paths are not followed. A concrete, reality-based contemplation of history aims to follow the path to the mystery of Golgotha from the most varied perspectives. Today, however, since people cannot come up with valid reasons against spiritual science, they use anything possible to denigrate those who carry spiritual science. They become personal. And it is, I truly say this without resentment, a dreadful sign of inner poverty in those who turn against anthroposophical spiritual science today, that they decline to show an interest in spiritual science, that they only ever traipse around it from the outside, and that they, for example, portray the Christ event and the Christ experience as though anthroposophy were rationalizing the mysterious aspects, as though it were dragging the very thing that should be approached with pious reverence down into the sphere of ordinary rationalistic knowledge. Just give some thought to the following. If a human being stands in front of us and we look at him, then it is not as though the mystery, which every person is to us, were to be lost just because we do not only hear things about him, but can also see him. If the individual human being cannot be evaluated with rationalistic concepts, then how much less is this the case of the very event that appears to us as the highest meaning of earthly evolution, the mystery of Golgotha. The mystery is not lost because we are led to a perception of it, and anthroposophy aims to lead from what is only communicated or believed to what becomes understandable through observation. Nothing is taken away from what constitutes the mystery. The mystery is there, but it should not just be discussed. Rather, it should be put in front of a perceiving humanity. This is how the critics talk around the subject today, instead of entering into what is actually contained in the anthroposophical literature itself. It is not necessary to go into everything that comes from this side, but there should be a strong awareness within anthroposophical circles that as the anthroposophical movement expands and asserts itself, it will be met by a proportional increase in hatred. What we have achieved so far already contains strong bits for the opponents, but you can be assured that this will still be outdone in due course. And even if Eurythmy is being criticized once again as it has been in the last few days, then it seems to me that we should say to ourselves, in reality, there would only be reason for worry if praise were to come from this side. For then, I would have reason to ask myself, what should we be doing differently? This is what should become a natural, healthy feeling in anyone who wants to be part of the anthroposophical movement in the right way. What I have presented to you today is, in a certain sense, an expansion of what I was privileged to discuss the last time I was here. There is, of course, much more that can be said, but what I have indicated today should also help bring you a little further in the field of Christology. The end of Lecture 4.